Thank you for attending session 261 entitled Roots of the Mormon Family Tree. Before we begin, and most of you have probably heard this 1,000 times, but still it bears repeating 1,001 times. Before we begin, we ask that cell phones be turned off and those attending be respectful and attentive. It is the mission of Sunstone to host thoughtful and respectful dialogue. Please keep that in mind when engaging in the Q&A portion of this session, following the remarks of the presenter. Those who cannot abide by those guidelines should refrain from commenting and will be asked to leave should they become disruptive. This session is being recorded, and you will be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. Take advantage of our symposium special by subscribing to Sunstone Magazine, 7 issues for the price of 6 at the registration desk as well. Consider also purchasing Skull Candy headphones customized just for Sunstone. Your support goes directly to keeping symposiums and 40 years of thoughtful dialogue alive and sustainable. Don't forget to check out the bookstore in the ballroom hosted by Benchmark Books. Consider purchasing a book or two to support Mormon studies and scholars. This session is 60 minutes long, and we ask both audience and our presenter to keep within the framework of that time so that we can allow for the next session to start on time. As a courtesy to other presenters and our attendees, we ask that immediately after this session you clear the room and speak outside so other presenters can begin preparation for the next session. Okay. Although there are many branches of Mormonism, perhaps we have more in common than we realize. What are the differences between Mormon fundamentalist beliefs and LDS beliefs? What are the similarities? Where do the roots of the tree branch out, and where do they begin? Winston Blackmore, our presenter tonight, is the leader of a polygamist Mormon fundamentalist group in Canada. For 2 decades, Blackmore was the bishop of the Bountiful British Columbia group of the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the FLDS Church, and was excommunicated by FLDS Church President Warren Jeffs in September of 2002. With that, I will leave it to him.
I brought me some notes this time. I think I'm going to start my story with my father, my grandfather. In Devon County in England, John and I went over there to hunt up my old forefathers and discovered that there's 4 or 5 generations of my grandfathers buried in the same cemetery in the same county over in the Exeter, England area. And so that's where my grandfather, William Morris Blackmore, was born, to William Morgan Blackmore and Sarah or Marianne Morris. They had quite a crew of children, and he was, I believe, the youngest son in that group. Grandfather, at the age of 12 years old, apprenticed on a merchant sea ship. And, you know, at 12, they could sign their own contract. They were obligated to fulfill their 8-year apprenticeship program, and they were tattooed on their front and their back with their apprenticeship program and the date. So grandfather was tattooed so that in case he decided to desert on the ships as he came and went, so did the Mormon missionaries. And he heard about the Book of Mormon story and became very interested in the Mormon faith. Eventually, joined the Mormon Church, the LDS Church. He also had relatives in Sublette, Idaho, just off of Pocatello down here. Great-grandmother's sister was married to a John Henry Horn down there, and they had some children who had children, one of them being Mary Christina Horn, who was my grandmother. Grandfather started a small farm when he got out of the Merchant Marines in the Sublette area, built a little house, and was farming 40 acres of property when he decided to take a trip and marry his longtime sweetheart over in England and bring her back to the farm. When he got over there, her relatives brought alcohol to the reception before they got married, and great-grandfather had a fit. He said, "You will not be serving alcohol in this session, and alcohol makes Blackmore stupid." And the other guy stood up and said, "If you believe that, you're stupid already." And they got into an interchange of opinion. Finally, my father asked his fiance if she was going to go with the opinion of her, or my grandfather, her family, or his. And she said, "Well, I'm siding with my family." So, in true, not very well thought out fashion, he turned around and went down to the boat, got on. As a merchant seaman, he could get on any boat that was sailing. They all knew him. He was quadlingual. He could speak four languages. And he took passage and went back to Sublette. When he showed up there without his wife, he just simply said she was so miserable, we tossed her overboard. Which was not the case, but that was what he said. He said to Mary, who was 16, he said, "You know what, you're just probably going to have to marry me or I'll never get married." And she said, "Let's do it." So they made the trip to the Logan Temple and were married in the Logan Temple by, I don't know, which was the patriarch of the temple. But he must have really loved her, because one long day later, they discovered that he had left their wedding ring at the altar and somehow or other in the Logan Temple, and they got back in their wagon and went all the way back, adding a couple more days to their trip. Anyway, it was kind of something that happened. When they got home and started to farm, grandfather got into a quarrel over water rights. And I thought that was just the stuff of Louis L'Amour stories, but he experienced it and he didn't want to quarrel with his brethren in the church, so they started to look for a new place to go. And one of the papers they were looking at was Canada was advertising quarter sections of land for homesteading. Anyone who would come and improve on their land and build a house and go from there. So a part of their teaser on their ad was is that you can work in shirt sleeves in February. Well, anybody who knows southern Alberta knows that a Chinook will come a-rolling in there and it'll be like 65 degrees Fahrenheit for a while, but in 33 seconds, it's 30 below. And I mean, they go from one extreme to the other that fast, but grandfather went over there anyway, and about 3 miles to the Waterton side of Cardston, anybody who's been to Cardston, he staked out a homestead. Nice stream going through there. He started to build him a sod hut and just about froze to death the first year. Anyway, if it hadn't have been for the kindness of, and I'm going to take this minute to brag about the Canadian free spirit brethren, because they took him home instead of shut off his water and thawed Grandpa and Grandma. And they thawed them out and then helped them get established when they got going again. And they continued on with their large family. They had 11 old children that I knew, myself, my aunts and uncles. The oldest being, at least the oldest son being John Blackmore, who was a member of parliament in Ottawa for 22 years. Uncle John was an orator, and he taught his siblings how to how to do great orations and filibuster and preach long and loud, and they were already good at that. But along and about in the middle of all of that, Grandpa died. He died when my father was 2 years old. His youngest was an infant, 3 months. And here was Grandma, 49, with 11 children to raise. And she went ahead and started doing her work, you know, raising her family. And as she took on that task, of course, Uncle Jim was 18, and he was the oldest boy home, and he saw to it that she had what she needed. And anyway, and every time Uncle John would come down, these guys would debate. They grew up debating. They debated the scriptures, and they learned poetry, and they were tough and proud and staunch Mormons that were raised in the strictest of every sense. I visited Uncle Jim one time, and there were guys who wouldn't drink coffee, but they would pour out a cup of Postum. I mean, talk about an insult of, you know, one or the other. But that's what they did. I mean, and I, you know, my father needed neither of those, and so neither do I. In 1938, my father was sent on a mission. He received a missionary call and was sent on a mission to New Zealand. He was there about 2 months after Brother Cowley, Matthew Cowley, was set apart as the mission president in New Zealand. So Father spent his whole mission under the presidency of Brother Cowley, who was the son of Apostle Matthias Cowley, who right not far, about 30, 40 miles from Cardston, there's a little town called Cowley, and it's there today, and descendants of Brother Cowley still live there, and the ones I know are great people. Anyway, he spent his time in the mission field, and Brother Cowley sent him on a little special errand after they all learned how to speak Maori. He sent him on a little errand to go and reclaim some of the Maori people who were still continuing to live plural marriage. Plural marriage was a part of their culture as well as their faith. And he sent him over to speak with this old one particular brother. There was a couple of them, these elders, and they were, you know, the Maori people that he was speaking to were colored people of color. And Father said, there was no one who had greater faith. Those people had some of the greatest faith. I think Brother Cowley told the story of them having enough faith to be healed, to see, and so on. But anyway, Father went to try to convince these guys that they needed to come back into the fold. And you remember, he was a very proud, faithful Mormon himself. And he just could not convince these old brethren. They showed him the lectures on faith, and they told him, you know, if the gospel is a changing gospel, well, then how can we have any faith in God? Using the Prophet Joseph's very arguments in the face of my father, kind of hurt his feelings. And when he got home from his mission in New Zealand, he took the debate up with his brethren. They could recite the scripture and poetry and everything else. And just Father just was churning. He was churning in his heart over, could this possibly be, you know, what did this all mean to them? He tried to get Brother Cowley to help him out here. And at the end of the day, whatever this old elder's name was, he said, Elder Blackmore, he said, come back when you can give me some more enlightenment. He said, I don't need to belong to the church, to be an active member of the church to live my religion. And so that's just basically what he did. Anyway, in 1940, the missionaries were all sent home from New Zealand. Father was sent home too. The war was pending. And in that time that he got back, he met my mom. She was a girl that was living in Beezer, which was just a 3 or 4 miles from Cardston, a little bit to the south and the west. She lived with an old couple named the Winders, Charlie and Aunt May Winder. And in the middle of all her wanting to hook up with my dad, then she had to listen to all of these endless Blackmore debates between Uncle Jim and Uncle John and Rich and Dan and Pete and Bill. And these guys were very faithful, devoted people. Mother had a girlfriend. Her name was Aloha Beamer. And when Mother got married, well, her best friend Aloha decides she's going to go with him on their honeymoon. And my father wasn't impressed with that at all. He was one of these guys that believed we'll just do plural marriage in the next life when we can sit in the heavenly city and you know, have two wives and pour a cup of coffee. I mean, I don't know, I guess. Anyway, so he, that's just kind of what his thought process was on all of that. But they heard about the brethren of the, of what we call the old, what I call the old priesthood council in the 1886 revelation, and they saw the evidence of it, and they invited some members to come and speak to them, in which case Charles Hitting and Leroy Johnson and some others came along to visit with them too. On the second or the third visit, after Father had married my mom in the Cardston Temple under the sealing hand of President Wood, then Mother and what would soon become my mother, Aloha, they had this really good idea that she should join their family. And everybody was happy about that except my dad. So he didn't like the idea at all, and he wasn't one bit interested, but the old brethren of those days had kind of a knee-jerk reaction whenever they found, they were so anxious to do their business that whenever they found someone willing to do it, they didn't waste any time of getting all the parties together, and it was in such a case that they were picking fruit in an orchard in Beezer that they called everybody together, and lo and behold, my father entered what was called the principle of plural marriage with Mother Aloha. Well, he soon moved. There were really no strangers. Uncle John was married to Emily Woolley, and they were familiar with the Woolleys and with the Woolley story, and apparently enough to embrace and to want to embrace that cause, and this is what they did. You know, that's my dad's history. That's not mine. So, anyway, they soon moved over to British Columbia, what was called the Lions Ranch, which is where we live today. And I was born on the property 60 years ago in August. And I was my father's 13th child. So growing up the way that we grew up in a family like that, we were dairymen. We had a herd of sheep. We grew our gardens. We canned and picked berries and did all the stuff that we did to sustain ourselves. And there was nobody more important in our family than Mother Aloha. She could milk cows and shoot coyotes and skin bears and every last thing that came along with living in a family like we did. Mother said she'd have a baby and pass it to her and go do the chores. And so my siblings and I, we never did ever refer to, we were never half brothers or half sisters. Our father, that was an insult to him. We were brothers and sisters in our family, and it was no bliss. It was tough, and it was tough for the moms, and it was tough for dad, and it was tough on anybody that sits back and thinks, oh, holy cow, plural marriage is so lovely, so easy, and so nice. I'm telling you, it's tough. It's tough to go on in life and to live like that, but you know, I still am so grateful that my father lived the way that he lived. I know his intentions in his life were just. There was no greater woman than that lady who wanted to come into his life and be a part of his life. She kept his economy going, and she kept his family going. And every day of my life right now, I deal with a couple of my brothers that are involved with me in our industry, and they're her children. And you know, we got back in the days when they were telling us to, in our side of the equation, they were telling us to abandon our relatives that weren't entirely believing the same way we were. But we put together a program, built her a house. And that helped expedite our expulsion from that program, which was all good stuff, as far as I'm concerned. In 1970, Father got cancer, a form of cancer, leukemia, which they determined was only 5% chance of his recovery. And, you know, the very same cancer nowadays has a 95% recovery rate. So, you know, good things have happened in the field of medicine. About when I was in about my 15th year, in about 1972, we had a conference. People came from all over the place, and I was having a struggle in my faith. I was having a struggle with my life. You know, anybody have a 15-year-old, and do they struggle? This 15-year-old may struggle in a situation like common, ordinary 15-year-olds, but in a 15-year-old in our society was in for a real struggle. And we listened to people talk about everything you could possibly imagine that didn't make any sense to me. And finally, my father, who was the presiding elder, oh, by the way, he was the presiding elder, he said to us children one day, he said, "Have you guys done the Book of Mormon challenge? Have you taken the Book of Mormon challenge? Have you read this thing and then gone out in your private place and asked God to show you if this Book of Mormon was true?" And if ever anyone ever needed to hear that at that time, it was me. Because, you know, he says, "You know what?" He said, "You're not going to have the angel Moroni show up. He's not going to bring you the Book of Mormon, and I mean the gold plates, and show you. And he's not going to show, let you feel it." There was three witnesses that had that privilege. The eight witnesses aren't going to show up. I mean, you're not going to give the plates for somebody to see you. But he'll answer you by that feeling in your heart that this Book of Mormon was true. And he said, and that'll be a good place for you to start. So, which is what I did. And I was happy to have that feeling in my heart that our faith was all about Christ. Because that's the story of the Book of Mormon, is that our faith is all about Christ, about his coming into the earth, about his resurrection, about the atonement, about, you know, the time that he touched the stones, and the whole thing just points anybody who reads it to our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. And that is where I want to go with my life. You know, Father died in 1974, and I had the privilege of being right connected with Uncle Roy, Leroy S. Johnson of the old Priesthood Council fame, and got my training from him. He was a decent, a non-judging, peaceful person who corrected me more often than I wanted, but I'm sure thankful that he did. Anyway, he commissioned me in 1980 to the ministry of our faith. He showed me his minister's license, and he commissioned me to keep my faith alive, keep my family going, and to keep on in that business. And I served with him till 1986, in which time he died, and I met, well, I'd already met Brother Jeffs, but I served with him until he, till 98, when he had a stroke. My life was fully involved in so many people's lives. They had people come into my life and family, and just to kind of give you an example, I heard a little bit about Edith's little conversation yesterday, so I thought just maybe some of you guys would like to hear the story about how Edith and her sister came into my life. And just for the sake of it, just for the fun of it, you know, we were strictly forbidden to court. Courting was strictly forbidden in our faith. If you were courting and Brother Jeff found out about it, well, then you just about lost your head. It was not, and I say today to those people that I join, and, you know, I still do bishop duties 35 years later for our community, and I reserve the right to give a little bit of a pep talk to everybody. And one of the very first things that I say to anybody and everybody is, I want you to not even think about polygamy. Don't even think about you two guys to start out your life and love each other and stay focused, because as I have been taught, as Brother Johnson taught me, and as I have known, plural marriage is not even legal for a person unless there's something, some other way. So I couldn't go court, and I didn't. And all the people that ended up in my life, I never courted one of them. Did I? Not anybody. And so, so one day, I'm in my office minding my office business, and I had a lot of business to mind. And the knock comes on my door, and here comes this girl. That girl. And I'm right there. And she said, I need to talk to you. Yeah, okay. I was commissioned in our church to listen to those kind of girls, and hundreds of them came along, but not with the plan that she had. And anyway, so I says, yeah, okay. And here's the first things that we asked. This is how I helped her qualify her feelings. I says, well, how'd you come by these feelings? Oh, I don't, you know, I just feel in my heart like this is what I need to do. And I said, okay, well, are you guys being lovers? You know? Yeah. So I'm just being Bishop Winston Blackmore, sitting at my desk, and here comes this damsel, and she's saying, you know, can you help me figure this out in my life? And sure, I'm commissioned to do that. Well, and I asked her, I said, are you courting? Oh, no, we're not courting. And I said, well, have you got something going with, is this guy already married? Oh, yeah, he's married. Says, well, are any of the other ladies, is his ladies courting you up? Oh, no, they're not courting me. And so we talked back and forth, and I never asked her, and she never told me. I said, well, you know what, I think that you ought to kind of go talk to your father, tell him the feelings in your heart. And, No, I'm not going to talk to my dad. And I said, well, you need to. You need to go tell your dad how you feel. He can, and honestly tell him what you're thinking, you know, and be honest with him. Because isn't being honest much better than not being? So go tell your dad and go from there. Well, away she went, and I really didn't think much more of it. It was pouring rain out there, and that night in my office at home, I need another little knock on the door, and here comes another girl. And she's, how much older was she? 5 years older? She was 5 years older than Edith, and these guys were seeing who could be the oldest maids, I guess, I don't know, in our society, but she said, "You talked to my sister," and she was quite angry at me, and I told her, "Yeah, I did," and we had a pretty good talk, and mind your own business, you know. And so finally, we sat down there, and she had me talk to her about, I said, "Well, what is your trouble?" Well, I was commissioned to ask people who they had in mind. And finally, I pressured her and I said, she said, "Well, it's the same person as my sister." "Really? That's unusual." "Yeah, because it's the same person." And I says, "Well, okay." I mean, I didn't even really know these girls before that. And she said, "Don't you know?" And I said, "You tell me." And then she told me, "It's you." I said, "Me?" And I told her, "As God's my witness, our interview is over with." I had to tell her that day. But, you know, all hell broke loose after that. They finally went and told their dad, and he was mad, and he's still mad. All his grandkids later, and he's still mad. And anyway, that's how that came about. Is he still mad, Dolly? Okay. One of his grandkids. That's good. That's a start. Anyway, so in my life, that's kind of how it came along. And just, how much more time do I have, moderator? Okay, so I want to tell you one last story. Okay, I'm going to tell you one last story of why we left the FLDS. Just so you guys know. We can say we were sick of it. We were. But we can also not tell you the truth of this, and we would be probably not being entirely forthright with this little session by not telling you the story. But there came two boys. Uncle Winston. They called me Uncle Winston because I was a ranking officer, I guess. And they said, "We're told we're sons of perdition and we're sent away for good." I said, "Well, who did you kill?" I asked the first guy, "Who'd you kill?" "Well, I didn't kill anybody." I said, "Well then, will you tell me the day that you saw the face of God and altogether turned therefrom?" "Well, I didn't do that either." And so I asked the other boy, "Who did you kill?" Same question. "I didn't kill anybody." And I said, "Well, what did you do?" "Well, they picked up a couple of girls, sisters, and they took them to the movie and they fed them some popcorn and they got caught. And they were sons of perdition for doing that." And I just laughed. I said, "You know, I want you to go straight back to whoever told you that baloney and tell them that is just the dumbest, stupidest thing," and blah, 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 you know. And anyway, so they were both happy about that, and they went down and they told Brother Jeff's. He came back and talked to me, and he said, "Did you tell those boys that?" I said, "Yes, I did." And he said, "I was the one who told him to go away." And, you know, my stomach turned from acid to alkali in a second, you know. And I said, "I just want to ask you one question. Did I tell them the truth or did I lie to them?" And he said, you told them the truth." And I said, "Brother Jeffs, you just as well have shot those boys in the back of their heads. You killed their hope. If you kill somebody's hope, you killed their faith." And he just broke down and wept. And he said, "I am so tired of all of this. I can't do this anymore. I'm not going to help another person fix their life. And in a handful of days, maybe four, John, was it? He had his stroke and he never helped another person fix his life. And then along came Warren and along came Vanessa. There was this girl that was sent up there. She had had a situation that wasn't good and she was sent up. She was on Zoloft, Prozac, and you know, her eyes were spinning, and she came to our place. They sent her up to our place. But she didn't want to be married to the guy that she was married to. She didn't have a choice in her life, and she should have. And so they sent her up to our place. And at our place, it wasn't even a week, was it? And she was a happy and a fun and just a real fun girl. And she came along and she said to me, you know, would you help me get rebaptized? I said, of course I will. I called Brother Jeff's just because she'd come from there. They'd sent her up there. And he said, of course she can. And then after that, she said, would you help me get married? And I said, of course I will, on one condition. One condition, you cannot marry us, me and mine. I will not help you do that. I can't help you do that. And when Warren heard about it, he immediately commanded that she be sent away. He sent her father and Leroy Jeffs up to gather her up and told me this. Her father told me, too, there's nothing left for this girl but to go have her blood shed on the ground. And I said to them, well, she's not going anywhere. She's staying right where she is. And eventually, when she finally did go, it was not until after we'd alerted the FBI and the RCMP, and she was the safest girl in the United States and Canada before she had a chance to go anywhere. But, you know, my feelings and my heart, can you imagine? If we would have ever let that girl go and something like that would have befallen her. How anybody could ever have lived with anything that was less like religion or Christianity for the rest of their life. And we quickly decided, you know, we don't need to belong to that church to live our religion. And so we didn't, and we haven't. And our lives are full, and we have a multitude of boys and girls, and I love all my kids, even my wicked ones. And they have access to their dad more than enough. And that's just the way that it is. So there, you can ask some questions.
I just want to remind people to keep questions respectful. Don't ask questions that you wouldn't want a stranger asking you in a public place, please. And I'm fairly sure that you guys can handle this, so I'll just be here just in case.
If I can't hear the question, you're going to have to help me.
We have a great session. We want to make sure that those who are listening will have a chance to hear what you want.
I'll just be really happy if there wasn't any questions. But if you have one.
Sorry. First of all, I saw your wives and three of your daughters yesterday, and that was very enlightening to me. I was thoroughly impressed with them, and I really wanted to meet you to say I'm really impressed with you being their father. What do you attribute your success in polygamy to?
My success with my family has to do with a couple of simple little principles that I do, and that is that I believe that, one thing, we don't hit our kids. should sometimes, but we don't. I mean, we feel like we should, but we don't. Another thing, too, is that the greatest success that I've ever had in my life is the collection of just great, sweet ladies that have joined my family. And you may think that there's a whole, I mean, I just feel like the most blessed person on earth, although some of those people, and I will tell you that in 2002, when they made the great big show of excommunicating us, I gathered all the folks that were in my life, and I said to them, you girls are all willing to go or willing to stay, and I will help you stay or I will help you go. But, I mean, I love you dearly, and they are the greatest collection. That's the best success that I could ever say with the moms. I don't allow my children to complain about their mothers. I tell them just about every day, you know, I will not listen to you. Cuss your moms. I don't allow myself to, and this is just my own personal discipline, you know, I don't allow myself to criticize anybody else with, you know, of the mothers. The mothers know they can't get any seconds of my time to listen to them back and forth. I feel like that's really important because at the end of the day, if someone comes along and says, do you know what Winston said about you? They all know right away, he didn't say anything about me. And that's just what they know. And that is one of the things I religiously, I'm third generation, by the way, of what I do. And I don't allow myself to do that. Plus, they're just a bunch of good girls. That's the way it is. Some of them have left our family, but none of them have left me. In the middle of the night, if their drains don't work, well, then I still get phoned. And, you know, whatever else is their problem. And that's, you know, about the way it is. And thank you for the compliment to the girls. I love my girls.
Sorry, second question. I know it's been 14 years, but do you still maintain communications with the FLDS group down in the Hilldale area, down south? And what is your perspective now after all this, time of what has happened there versus what has happened in your area?
I still talk to a lot of people down there from there. You know, out of the blue, someone will phone and that I've long ago been connected with. And I do guarantee you that we didn't make the wrong choice when we decided that we were just going to carry on with the faith of our old fathers. You know, my dad, he didn't judge anybody, and he didn't want us to judge anybody. I don't judge people. I just don't want my children judging them. I just feel like that a lot of those folks were trapped in a situation that they didn't know anything about. I did know about it. John and I talked back and forth, and he soon got cut off. But anybody that talked to me about anything got in trouble. And yet, you know, if I have a regret, maybe that regret is that I didn't stand up and start publishing to the world what was happening. But I don't think the outcome would have been any different. So that's 14 years ago is a long time. And I didn't ever even know Warren Jeffs as a leader. I just knew him as a principal of Alta Academy. You know, that's all I knew him as.
Hi there. Winston, your story is fascinating, and I really enjoyed listening to the woman who presented to us yesterday as well. I've got a master's in demography, and one of the things that fascinates me about the practice of plural marriage is how to make it work. Like if it's an eternal principle that everyone should be living, how do we make it work like on a global scale or even with any population with boundaries? Because the number of men and women that are born are about similar. So what do you do with all of the excess boys if there are multiple women? That's my my question. Does it make sense?
All our boys.
Yeah, because there'll be about the same number of boys and girls born. Yeah. But if plural marriage is a principle which is a principle of exaltation and it needs to be lived, how can it be in a population that's reasonably even numbers of boys and girls?
Well, that's a good question. But you know what? There's not near as many boys ever interested in plural marriage as there is girls. You guys might think that isn't true, but it still is true. You get a situation where you find a couple of girls, and I've had a couple of girls from New York show up, and they asked me what I could figure out for them. One was a Jew, and one was LDS. One was 35, and one was 34. They were best friends, and they wanted me to see if I could find them somebody that would take both of them on. They were both career girls that would have a baby or two and stay home and tend them while they supported them. But they were in love with each other. I mean, they loved each other. And, you know, I'm not interested in exploiting those girls, but they had a valid point. And, you know, all over the place, plural marriage is not going to work if people go at it in the wrong way. It ain't going to work anywhere. All you guys in here could decide you're going to be a polygamist and me some more. And we'd all fail miserably if it wasn't driven from a different direction. And I, in my faith, my own personal faith that I've espoused, you know, I say to my boys that get married, and we've connected with quite a few other groups of people, and thankfully so, because our boys are marrying their girls, and we're actually finding a base for our kids. But, you know, give an example, one of my boys, he's not one bit interested in religion. He said, "Dad, I'm sure not going to live plural marriage." And I said, "Son, if I can find one girl dumb enough to hook up with you, I'll be so happy. I'll be the happiest guy." You know, because and he said, "Well, that's not nice." And I said, "No, it isn't nice, but it's, I'm a dad, I love you. If I can find a girl that's just willing to hook up with you and you guys just do your life together, then I am going to be so happy to see you whenever I see you come along." And you know, I have that bit of a relationship, but as long as their lives are driven by their choice, one thing that we have learned in the midst of all of that is that people have to want to do this. They have to want to do it, or it isn't ever going to work. Either you have to be in love with the same God, and you have to want to do this. And if you aren't, well, then don't even give that a try. And yet, you know, year after year after year in our conferences, somebody would stand up and say, "Oh, we got to be polygamists before we're going to go to the celestial kingdom." I totally do not believe that that is true. Because if you put the parameters of celestial and plural marriage as contemplated by the Book of Mormon and Jacob, as contemplated by our traditions, which were that you could not go courting, then how does a person do that if he can't do it? So how do you enter into that principle if you can't go do that? Is it even possible? It isn't even possible. So, anyway, that to me, I mean, I would never, if I was the Prime Minister of Canada, I would never make polygamy legal. And those suckers are after me by day and by night, you know. I got to go another round with them. And I would never do that because it is a principle that could be so easily exploited for the wrong reason, you know. And I just honestly believe that. That's a part of what I believe. So I don't think that anybody should ought to feel like that they're second-rate citizens because they're not living what they're all waiting for the celestial kingdom to do. You know, I don't have any problem with that. Anyway. Are we done? Oh.
Since you mentioned your legal issues, I am an attorney, so I'm interested in what's going on with you legally. It's been a while since I've caught up with that, and would love to hear kind of a little summary of what you've been through with that.
Okay. Well, I think it was 2007. I got arrested and charged with polygamy. And, you know, the government, our government has been doing an investigation on us. We've been hiding in plain sight since all of our whole entire lives. And they've been doing an investigation on us for polygamy, because polygamy is on our statutes against law. Well, finally they got bold enough to actually go and they arrested me right in front of my kids. I got handcuffed and stuffed in a police car, and, you know, and I, handcuffs are just not comfortable for me, so I had to ask the brethren there if they would please put two pairs on, or like I was a real fugitive, I was going to run away, and there's four of them with guns, you know, I was going to get around that. And anyway, we started going to court, and they beat him the first round for prosecutor shopping. They kicked it out, and then they recharged me again for polygamy because they just determined they're going to run this thing up the flagpole. So to the Supreme Court of Canada, which, by the way, there will probably be the case that because our Supreme Court is so liberal now, I mean, they have, and rightly so, given the gay and lesbian community their rights to be what they are and to be who they are, and rightly so. And, you know, so for us, in the middle of all of this, we've spent $400,000 of, you know, just to get right back where we started from. And, you know, so here we are. We got to go for another round. And I'm really kind of glad to be able to do this right now, because by the time the one's going on in Nauvoo, I'll probably be inadmissible to the United States again. And, you know, you might have to put up with some more of my kids and ladies and whatnot over there. But so we're going through that again. Only this time, I'm just going to stop by the U.S. Customs and ask them, okay, so what if I go plead guilty to live in my religion? All right, I'm guilty of being third generation what I am. What are you going to do? And the U.S. guy says, we're going to not allow you to come into our country until you go through our waiting period of 5 years and get and buy a $585 pardon from us. So I guess I have to face that. But we have decided this all along. That what? Oh, yeah. Yeah. So in the legality of it all, Canada has this thing called the child tax benefit. And, you know, these, you know, children, any child born in Canada, even to Prime Minister Trudeau, has a little monthly check that they get. And it's been going on ever since 1892, you know, when Canada became a country. And so, but with that, you have to claim your spouses. So for me, they made me claim all my ladies' revenue just so that they didn't have to pay us any of this child tax benefit. It's based on, you know, it goes down on a graduated scale. We went through that, and then we said, all right, you guys, if you're going to claim these girls as spouses, I want to immigrate them all. You know, they're U.S. citizens, and if they're going to be a spouse, well, they changed the law in a hurry over that so they didn't have to let me immigrate these polygamous criminal women that are connected to my life. And then they made a new law about common law. So common law associations, marriages, well, they'd allow you to immigrate common law, but you had to claim common law. And I think right now their official, the way that they require that we officially declare ourselves as we're friends, is that the way? We just are friends. And yet they still charge us with polygamy. But we can't be spouses, and we're not, because we don't have a legal... I mean, a marriage in our country is a contract between two people with a marriage license. Yes, have a marriage license. That's considered a marriage. We don't have any of those. I don't have any of those in my life. And so, you know, our province ran it through the judicial system, and they determined, this is actually on the law, that you can have as many women in your life as you want. You can have as many children in your life as you want. What? Okay. You can have as many women, many children in your life, but you can not have more than one commitment. And that's even if you go out behind a barn where nobody's looking and commit to somebody. If they find it out, you have broken the law. Can you even wrap your mind around, you're an attorney, can you wrap your mind around how that works? Because this is a judge that decided this. And that's the way that it is in Canada right now. Anything else goes. So for us, that's the legal stuff that we're involved with. And we were involved, some of you guys from the LDS Church might be interested in this, because we were involved in a little bit of a, we were fighting our life over the congregational issue. We lived like the Hutterites. Anybody heard about them? Okay, so the Hutterites, they have this congregational, this tax break just for them. We were living like that in a congregation, and they just gave me $1 million tax bill, slapped me with $1 million. And we fought that, and we lost because we weren't Hutterites. So that's what we did, you know, that way. And then, so in an effort to show we were connected to other people, because Hutterites have to be connected to other colonies who think the same as they do, believe the same, practice the same. Well, then my lawyer was a Catholic, and I should have had him be a Mormon because he would give me some better guidance, but he got searching, and the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints had not protected their name in one jurisdiction. That's the province we lived in. They had not protected their name. They couldn't imagine such a thing. They couldn't imagine it either. They didn't know how it slipped by. And so we registered. So I registered that with that name because we've always considered it LDS, you know. And I got a call from Toronto, and then I got to communicate through my lawyer with the First Presidency, and they finally determined that we could call ourselves, this is the First Presidency of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, has determined that we could legally call ourselves the Church of Jesus Christ Original Doctrine. No kidding. That's what they decided. So, but we couldn't call Latter-day Saints, or we couldn't use Mormons.
Well, just real quick, because we're running out of time, but what would you say is the biggest change that resulted from your split with the FLDS as far as, I guess, possibly doctrine or just like practices within your community?
So for us and our children, the biggest thing, the biggest gift, I guess, from that is that we were able to re-give our children the gift of having their say, the freedom of their own choice, because our children have the right to choose and the freedom to decide, hey, I want to do this, or no, I do not want to do this. So that was how Brother Johnson trained me. That was his training to me. He wanted to have these people have their choice, and we've been able to restore that back to our life. And so I'm done. Thank you.